What is up, everybody, and welcome to the Keeping It 1000 podcast presented by DraftKings Sportsbook, America's top-rated sportsbook app. Download the app now and use promo code DNVR when you sign up. I'm Adam Matez, your host today, and I'm joined by the star of the show, Coach George Karl. Coach, how you doing today?
It's cold, baby. It's cold outside.
It is cold outside. You guys don't see him. He's decked out fully in Sonics gear. Some pretty cool-looking Sonics gear, too, I got to say.
Yeah, I got a little Sean Kemp and a little hat, old school.
Yeah, it looks nice. It's sad the Sonics being gone now for so long there, because the look, I'm looking at it now and I'm thinking it looks classic. It almost looks old school, which is weird because it doesn't feel like it was that long ago the Sonics were around. But
well, Adam, it's time to get back to Seattle, to be honest with you. This is a little ridiculous. David Stern, Adam Silver, we got to wake up. It's time to get back.
I feel like the NBA is going there. I mean, I feel like expansion is right around the corner, I think Seattle's
COVID expansion. You mean
to make up some lost revenue? Is that what you're implying here? Yeah, absolutely. That's part. I think the NBA wanted to expand before this, but you know, this gives them the perfect. I think everybody on board with it. That's just kind of my read on the situation. But the fans in Seattle are good. I mean, it's definitely a city that can handle it and loves their basketball. So I want to recap. There's a lot to get to today. I've got kind of a lot of little topics because I think the last 2 weeks have been interesting. When we did our last show, the Nuggets were streaking. 5 games in a row they had won. Since then, they went on a little 3-game losing streak and then a 3-game winning streak. So they're 3-3 since we last spoke. 3 losses in a row came to the Lakers, the Kings, who have their number apparently this season, and Milwaukee. And then, you know, 3 wins against Cleveland, Oklahoma City, and the Lakers. 2 of those kind of gimmies. And then this Lakers game, I think, a little bit more important to them. Let me first ask you, you know, we know Michael Malone comes from Sacramento. We know that he doesn't wear purple. I'm wondering with you, you know, were there teams or players or different things you went up against that, you know, you personally, you just had the, you brought a chip to your shoulder when you went into those games, and maybe winning felt a little better, losing felt a little worse.
Well, I always felt that for me, coaching against your friends or coaching against someone that was on your staff, like a Terry Stotts or a Dwayne Casey or a Nate McMillan, someone that you know really close. Pop, you know, was on my staff on the USA team. And so I thought always the friends got me more pumped and more fired up. And then I watched an extra game or two to see if I can sneak something in on them and maybe trash talk them along the way. And you always like going back to where you came from and winning on that court.
Right.
Especially the first time.
Right.
You know, early, if you get fired and you want to go back, and you might get a few chairs, you might get a few boos.
Right.
But when that game starts, it's more like a playoff game. You're coaching and not taking chances rather than to take chances. And I think those are the two things that come to mind is my friends got me more pumped up than maybe my enemies. And I think the game that once you go back to that place for the first time, it's a big game for you.
Yeah. When you talk about the coaching tree, when you play against or coach against, I should say, a coach that was formerly on your staff, you know, how much do you think are you overthinking it because they spent so much time with you? They know how your brain works. They know all of your little tricks. I mean, is it that extra layer of thought because you're like, well, I can't use this one. They know this about me.
A little bit, I think a little bit there, but I've always been a coach that likes to change, you know, even in success, I tinker. So I've always thought I wanted to be a out of the box, a little bit ahead of the curve coach. I wasn't as much a copycat coach that I think a lot of coaches kind of do what's working in the league. I kind of want to be that guy that's creating something that might work.
Right.
And, you know, we double teamed in Seattle. And then, of course, the dribble drive offense here. And I mean, I think when we went to the dribble drive, we were in the top 5 offensively in offense in the NBA. without it.
Yeah.
But I just got tired of playing the same way and I wanted to be different. So I think it comes in a little bit different packages. You know, some guys are more cautious and more, you know, more basic. For me, I always like, I think even in success, you got to evaluate what's good and what isn't good. And you got to be able to make the changes to kind of make it enjoyable. And I think players kind of get tired of a system. You know, they kind of want some innovation. They want some, you know, I think they have fun sometimes when you bring in and you bring in a play from just say, you know, Chris Paul's favorite play and you call it Chris Paul.
Right.
And, you know, so you kind of try to make it fun because 82 games is tedious. It's long. And if you can't have fun playing the game, sometimes I think you're going down the wrong way.
So you said something, I think, that really kind of, you know, caught my attention, which is you said you think players get tired of running the same system. And I feel like the Nuggets have had a similar system in the Jokic era. I mean, he's such a unique player. And I'm kind of curious, it's been effective. The Nuggets have been a top five offense for several years in a row. But do you think there's ever just fatigue? Like, okay, it's working, but you almost made it sound like you got bored of something. Not that it wasn't working, you just got bored with it. Do you think players get bored with it, even if it's working?
Well, I don't, you know, I think players are always searching for playing time.
Mm.
And so if the system that you're running doesn't get them a lot of playing time, they'll probably want change, you know. And young players, I think, in today's game are, I think more, I see the NBA this year, I see more thirsty players trying to make their careers by scoring points.
Hmm.
And instead of building their repertoire up from being solid to maybe a good defender or a good rebounder or a good runner, you know, they want to go right to scoring. And I don't think that if I was an Asian, which I kill me if I ever decided to become an agent, please. If I was an agent, it seems today everything is predicated on your numbers. Yeah. You know, how you score. And I don't think that's good for the game. I think young players got to figure out how to stay in the league.
Yeah.
And if you're going to try to do it to scoring, you got to be really good. And you're going to fail more often than you probably succeed.
Do you think this has changed at all with the analytics revolution? I mean, are front offices maybe a little bit more aware than they used to be about, hey, yeah, this guy's scoring 20 a game, but the team's better when he's off the court and, you know, the advanced metrics say he's bad? Or do you think it's still points over everything when it comes to contracts and free agency?
You know, I'm not going to knock analytics. I mean, analytics, I think in the end, I think coaches now are saying it's good for the game. We're learning.
Mm-hmm.
But we're the one immediately affected by analytics. The philosophy of analytics is sometimes, hey, give this guy 20 games and see how he does. And let's evaluate that. Well, if we go 12 in those 20 games, I don't care what the analytics say. I'm not going to like it. You know, the feel of the coach, the feel of the rhythm of the locker room, you know, how the connection is going is also important to, because we're together every day. I mean, we're together and we're trying to figure out what we do well and how much fun we can have when we're doing well. But we also got to go through the misery of, as you said, a 3-game losing streak. And today's game is really, I think, in the bubble COVID world, you know, we're not getting the real NBA. We got a different NBA. The NBA doesn't have home court. No, NBA doesn't have fans. It seems like shooting is real now predicated by who gets hot and not predicated by the home court.
Right.
I think we all realize the three ball is growing in importance. And everybody is understanding that it's easier to score three than two.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there are a lot of coaches. I mean, I talk to maybe 20 coaches a month, maybe 25, college and pro. And there's a lot more coaches now saying, is the three-point shot, you know, is it hurting the game? Is it changing the game to the point there might not be another way to play?
Right. Night in, night out, you look at the box score, and oftentimes the team that made the most threes won the game. It's probably 85% of the time you could just look at the three-pointers made, and that's the winner. So
another one is free throws. If you win threes and free throws, you don't lose.
Yeah, it's a lock, yeah.
You don't lose very, unless you have 47 turnovers.
Right. So you mentioned young players, and that I think the story of, you know, the last 2 weeks in large part has been the emergence of RJ Hampton and Zeke Nagy. And when I say emergence, I mean emergence into the rotation, because by injury, you know, Gary Harris, PJ Dozier has gone down. Will Barton was absent this last game. There's just been opportunity for new guys. I want to start though with RJ Hampton. How do you know, what have you thought about his approach? This has been his opportunity to start playing. What have you thought about how he's approached his minutes so far?
I like him. I like his courage, I guess is the best way to phrase it. I don't think he's played that spectacular. He's had moments. He had the great dunk a couple games ago.
Right.
I like him because he looks like he cares about defense.
Right.
He's long and athletic. And offensively, I think he'll figure it out. I'm still, again, he's one of those young guys. Mm-hmm. If all of a sudden he tries to do it by being an offensive player, I think it's a mistake. I think he's got to figure out how he gets his foot in the door to get on the court. Then how's he getting on the court and stay on the court for 20 minutes every night?
Right.
And then the next step probably isn't in this year, but it'll probably be next year. Is it, can he get in a rotation where he plays more than that? I mean, I know all these kids come out of college thinking they're going to be all-star NBA players.
Right.
And I think we all know very few of them do become all-star NBA players. But a 10-year career in the NBA and getting into the playoffs and being a major cog in a good team, that's fun as hell. And I just think the spotlight of making a lot of money comes with scoring a lot of points. I still think winning is more important than your numbers. If you show to the NBA personnel people that you are a winning basketball player and that you help winning and you develop players. I mean, the one thing I love about what happened in the Super Bowl this year is Tom Brady. I mean, I've never said I'm a big fan of Brady. But I'll tell you what, after the Super Bowl, I was a big fan of Brady. Because, I mean, it wasn't necessarily his talent. It's his makeup, his inspiration, his connectiveness, his ability to take a team that never looked like it was together. And all of a sudden, it's more together than Kansas City, who's been dominating for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. The more I am just around the NBA, and I've only been around it now for 6 or 7 years, but the more I just think those things are that really is such a larger percentage of it than I think the casual fan realizes. They look at, you know, the stats and they look like the highlights or these different things, but that ability to lead and connect and just understand all the different dynamics, social dynamics, whatever, I think is just so underrated. And something I think about with the Nuggets and the story, we're going to talk about Jokic in a little bit. And I think him trying to learn those lessons is one of the stories of his season so far. But going back to RJ Hampton, this is why I asked, you know, about his approach, not even his performance, because to me, it really was about approach. You know, he doesn't look like he's trying to do anything on offense that he's not very clearly supposed to be doing. And then his effort and energy have just been really hard. And I feel like those are the things. And I wonder, you know, his agent is Mike Miller. And I wonder if having a former player in sort of your ear and sort of advising you, if maybe that helps. I imagine Mike Miller's the type of guy that says, hey, that's a veteran team that's been to the Western Conference Finals. They don't want you to score. They don't care. I wonder if that plays a part of it, having former players in your ear.
I'm a big fan of that. I think learning how to be a pro and having an idea that, you know, if you make $10 million for 10 years, that's $100 million.
Right.
No one needs more money than that.
Right.
Even though you might be better than the guy making $20 million.
Right, right.
And I mean, just the privilege of playing in the NBA, honor it by giving it the right attitude, a professional attitude, understanding, learning what it takes to be a pro. You know, taking care of your body, not going out and being a crazy guy on the off court.
Right.
You know, there's plenty of times to party in the summertime. And young kids, you know, sometimes they throw their career out because they make bad decisions off the court. And sometimes they make bad decisions as what they want to try to become as players.
I'm going to reference this interview. There was an interview with Ethan Strauss and Andrew Bogut, and I'm going to reference it a few times because I thought Andrew Bogut on the podcast was very candid. And I think it's rare for NBA players to be very candid when they do interviews like this. But he said that one of the talents that's most important to succeeding in the NBA that nobody would ever think or realize is the ability to be alone for long periods of time. And he cited, you go on these road trips and it's best for you oftentimes to be in your room for 7 or 8 hours a day. You're not getting into trouble. You're not going out. And he said, so many players can't do that. They get in their room for an hour. They say, I'm going to stay in tonight. And after an hour, they're bored. They don't know what to do. And they end up going out just because they're stir crazy. And I'm thinking about young players with this. And I'm thinking that's an interesting thing. You don't think about it, but a lot of people aren't comfortable being alone for long periods of time. And that, I mean, I'm just wondering if you could maybe speak to that. You being, you know, you've spent so many years on the road.
Yeah.
Is that a skill?
I think all human beings, and especially I think athletes or professionals like lawyers who have tremendous stressful situations, it's comfortable to be around people.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying you got to have someone by your side every minute of every day, but you know, it's like when we're on the road, I would say 90% of the time, the coaches had an open invitation to everybody that you guys go on, go and watch a game or just go get a bite to eat.
Right, right.
And, you know, if you want to just spend an hour with the guys, you can spend an hour. But I think, you know, just exchanging ideas and having the social part of the basketball world have some fun to it. I agree with that with Iguodala with players. I think players, young players, the combination of what they want in their life, they go on the road, and what avenues they choose and the friends they choose can be good.
Right.
And they also can be dangerous.
Yeah.
And that's not going to change, you know. And people with money, people gravitate with people with money and people who have some prestige and a brand. And because of that, I think our young players, you know, from a standpoint of going out, drinking, womanizing, hanging out, staying out too late, not taking care of their body, eating at the wrong time, messing up their sleep right. patterns. There's so many things now that young players, I think, learning the lifestyle, the professional lifestyle, and doing it well and smart will extend your career. Injuries might blow that up. But don't let nutrition blow that up. Don't let your stupidity or your failures as being disciplined blow that up.
Right. If I go back to RJ Hampton for one last one, just from what you've seen of him, you know, what kind of player do you think he should mold himself into? What should he be striving for based on his talents?
Why don't you tell me what you think? Because I haven't seen him enough to really fall in love with him. I mean, the whole thing comes down to right now is your voice is telling me you're excited about the young kids.
It's just new topic. It's like the new topic of this last 2 weeks. That's really it.
Okay, so you want to be a team that's developing players or you want to be a team that wants to develop a championship? And I have problems with this because you think it's funny. But this window is fine because it's caused by injury. But if they play well enough to start an argument and then turn the positive of being ready, good job, rookies, way to be prepared, keep it up. There's always going to be another opportunity. And there's negative energy to competition. And we talked about it. It's been in the Denver Nuggets philosophy and personality for 3 to 4 years, where at positions, you have people covering over each other.
Right.
I don't think that's good for where the Denver Nuggets are right now, in my opinion. I could be 100% wrong.
Right.
And maybe this is the year Denver wants to experiment because it's COVID. It's not real NBA basketball, and they want to be in position at the end of this year to make their moves. That might be their game plan. That might be what's going on at the Pepsi Center behind closed doors. I have no idea. But, you know, both kids, the kid from Arizona and Hampton, are definitely look like they're NBA players. But are they NBA players on a playoff team that has to win a game in Portland?
Right.
No, they are not. And I might be wrong, but I'll tell you what, history tells me I'm right.
Right. I always assumed both those guys, Ignaji and RJ Hampton, were going to get pockets of playing time like they are right now over these last 2 weeks, but that they ultimately would not be pieces of the playoffs. I always thought this was a keeping the pipeline full. It sounds like you're less concerned with keeping any kind of pipeline full of young talent. And part of this is, I think, Denver's strategy for growing. When I say Denver, I mean the Nuggets organization under Josh Kroenke and Tim Connelly. Part of their strategy has been you have to develop talent internally if you're Denver, because it's just too hard to get, you know, people coming to Denver. So better to grow your talent from within. So I've always thought this was part of the strategy, a little bit in pockets of minutes here. And then maybe next year, years after, they become role players.
Well, my recommendation to Josh and Conley would be have an open mind, have an open window to what can be, because I don't think a small market team has to have one philosophy. If you only have one philosophy, it might work, but you know, I think you got to be adaptable. Be in a small market. You got to be able to maneuver what can work and what can get us better every year. And if that means trading for a veteran player like Chris Paul a couple years ago and losing money, if you want to win a championship, I like that idea.
Yeah.
But if you're going to try to build a championship team like the Oklahoma City, who had Durant,
right,
Harden, Ibaka, who else am I missing?
Westbrook. Yeah. You still didn't get it done. Yeah.
Denver's not going to do that. Right. That's not going to happen.
Right.
I mean, that's the best building of young talent in the history of the NBA, my knowledge of the NBA drafts. Did they win a championship? No. And you're not going to, I mean, you got Jokic.
That's tough.
Okay, Murray's pretty good.
Right.
You know, there's stats out there that say, you know, you got to be adaptable. I mean, Denver, right. I think that's the one thing, being a small market. You don't have the luxuries that LA has and maybe the San Antonio, the championship teams have. People want to go play there. That doesn't exist. So you got to be adaptable and ready to make a move when it comes on. That's why I think sometimes, you know, I get frustrated because, you know, I don't know if the trades could have been made, but, you know, sometimes taking a step back allows you to go forward. But a lot of times taking a step back, thinking you're a young player is going to become a really good player.
Yeah.
That fails as often as it succeeds.
Well, if I'm honest.
Don't get me wrong, Adam, let me jump in here. I mean,
yeah.
I want them to clean up their roster.
Right.
You know, if they want to play RJ Hampton 20 minutes this year, I'm okay for it. But get rid of some of the other guys that are sitting in the back of the locker room pissed off all the time.
Right, right. It's interesting. This is why I like talking to you, Coach. I mean, these are the types of insights. I could tell how frustrating it is. Even this conversation we had, I could tell how frustrated you are with the logjam and the long-term plans with the Nuggets when they're in this sort of win now mode. So,
it happened. I mean, don't you get pissed off when you want Malik Beasley to get 32 the other night? I mean,
right. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you got to make a decision. You got to say, I think this guy is going to be the best player.
And then clear room for him and commit to that guy. Yeah.
And commit to it. And you might be wrong.
Right.
Yeah. You might have to sit up and say, hey, I was wrong.
Today's episode of the Keeping It 1000 podcast is brought to you with limited commercial interruption thanks to DraftKings Sportsbook, the presenting and title sponsor of this show. Right now, DraftKings Sportsbook, America's top-rated sportsbook app, is giving all new players the chance to cash $100. New customers can bet $1 on any team to hit a three-pointer in any basketball game this week. And if your team makes it rain, you cash $100. That's right. All it takes is for one three-pointer. This is modern basketball. There's a three-pointer every 2 minutes. All it takes, though, is one three-pointer being hit by your chosen team to turn $1 into $100. It sounds like a no-brainer. The slam dunk of an offer won't be around forever. So head to the App Store now, download the DraftKings Sportsbook app, and get in on all of the actions. If basketball isn't for you, why are you listening to the show, first of all? But second of all, if not, if you want to gamble on something else, DraftKings Sportsbook has daily odds on hockey, soccer, and so much more. They paid out over $7 billion to its customers since 2012, so they know a thing or two about big paydays. So download DraftKings Sportsbook app right now and use promo code DNVR when you do to get your shot to turn $1 into $100 when you bet on any team to hit a three-pointer in any basketball game this week. Must be 21 or older. Colorado only. New customers only. Restrictions apply. Winnings paid out in $425 free bets. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. And if you have a gambling problem, call 1-800-522-4700. I want to transition now to one of your former players. I think an interesting one in a lot of different ways. This is, again, coming from that same podcast. It's Andrew Bogut speaking on Andre Iguodala during the Warriors' of course, 2015 to 2016 incredible run. I'm going to read this, a long quote, but I'm going to read the whole thing here. He says he was playing basketball the right way. He would not stand the low IQ players to the point where it would be awkward because he'd be on them, or he'd go to management and he'd be like, get them the F out of here. They can't fit in here. I get it to an extent because the way we played, talking about the Warriors, a lot of the stuff we did was read and react. We had quick hitter plays and all that kind of stuff, but 40 of the 48 minutes we're playing in that flow state, that read and react, that, hey, when I go here, you better have my back. When I come off this way, you better space that way. If you wouldn't adapt, if you were from a system that was very regimented where you needed to be told where to go and stand, you couldn't play with us. And Andre, he would lose his mind. He wanted high IQ players. I'm interested about this for a couple of different reasons. One, of course, you had Andre Iguodala. You probably have a window into his personality in ways I'm sure Nuggets fans, of course, remember the 2013 playoffs very unfavorably, I think, with regards to Iguodala. And we can talk about that. But, you know, he was, in my estimation, a very smart player and a guy that could play in a very good read and react system. I love read and react basketball. I love flow basketball. I think it's the best form of basketball, regardless of personnel, but especially if you have high, you know, if you have a Jokic type player, you can get high IQ players around him. You can make something really special. And I'm wondering if you feel like Jokic, he doesn't have the personality of Andre Iguodala at all, but I wonder if he has the same sort of disdain for guys that can't figure out the, hey, every action has a reaction that everybody has to kind of constantly be reading. And if you can't do that, it, you know, maybe you're not meant for the Denver Nuggets. Maybe you're meant for another system.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think this is the first year I've seen a little bit of that mentality. Mm-hmm. I think he's angry at times when they don't play with a rhythm. I mean, yeah. The Oklahoma City game was, what an ugly game in the fourth quarter. I mean, it was, wow. And, you know, and fortunately they found a way to win that game. That game, by the way, that style of game on this road trip is going to be prevalent.
Right.
You got Atlanta, you know, you got Washington, you got Oklahoma City, I think, back on. And those are the games you want to win them like you won the Cleveland game. You want to win them easy.
Right.
You want to win them from the beginning and controlling it all the way to the end. It doesn't happen that way. It just does not happen that way in the NBA. And the great thing about NBA basketball, it's a long game. And so you can play a bad half, and then you got to play a great half the next half. And good teams know how to do that. The Lakers have been doing that for the last seven games. And last night they just said, when Davis walked off the court, it looked like LeBron walked off the court with him. You know, he was just kind of tired of not playing good basketball. And, you know, they got to get it back. They got to go out and practice and maybe tune up some things, yell and scream a little bit and get it back. And I think that's where Denver is. And maybe most of the league right now. Do you know, other than Utah, what you would call a consistent good basketball team? Philadelphia's had its moments.
They've been down the last couple, though, yeah.
The Clippers have had their moments. Denver looks like they fixed it. And then, oh, shit, they didn't fix it.
Right, definitely not.
And so I think the personality of the league, if I had to say right now, is inconsistent.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Back to high IQ players, though. You know, how do you teach? Is IQ just a thing you have? But when we talk about read and react basketball, a lot of players have come through an AAU system or even a college system that's very regimented. How do you teach flow basketball to young players? Or do some people get it and some people don't?
I think there are some guys that are way ahead of the curve in teaching flow basketball, way ahead of the curve. And then there are a lot of other guys trying to do a little bit of both. I want my flow. I want my sets.
Right.
And there is a philosophy to it that I believe in, that commitment is the word. If you commit to flow basketball, you know, you're going to give your offensive players, your players, you're going to give them a lot of offensive decisions. Coaches got to have some patience.
Right.
Coaches are going to realize you're going to have a bad game. You're going to realize that you're not going to look good all the time. And when coaches go on losing streaks and their team's not playing well, they go back to their old roots. Flow basketball was kind of a new thing. And there are some coaches in are ahead of the curve right now. Actually think Oklahoma City coach is doing a good job with their offensive players. I don't even know who they are, and they actually look like they play pretty good offense after that.
Right, right.
And are they going to win? They probably won't win 30 games, but that doesn't mean he's not doing a good job. So everything's predicated on winning. But flow basketball, there is a rhythm, and there are certain guys that do it better than others. And now that you have an NBA, the vast majority, probably two-thirds, probably three-fourths of the league want to play flow basketball. But I'm not sure there's three-fourths of the league's coaches want to play flow basketball.
Why is that?
Oh, you know, older coaches they get in their rhythm. You know, they have their fundamental philosophies that they want. And change is hard. Change is hard in all of us. And then the pressure and stress of making a change when you have to have patience for it to improve, to get to where it was going to be successful, then you're throwing a lot of losses in on the fire.
Right.
And losses is what creates energy in coaches to go back. The theory in coaching is, when you lose, cut your playbook in half and simplify and go back to your roots, go back to your fundamentals. So I think if you're on a successful team, you have the luxury, kind of like Denver, to maybe go on a two or three game losing streak because they're good.
Right.
And you're doing that to grow the rhythm of how you want to play. Makes sense. I think Golden State has done a good job of, early in the season, they looked awful.
Yeah.
And now they're looking like, I'm not sure they're a playoff team, but I know they're playing much better basketball.
They also reduced their big rookie. I mean, they had, the big man was the newcomer. Not really. He's trying to learn a whole new system. He's trying to learn flow basketball, and it was slow progress. It seems like, and I'm not trying to blame him or anything for this, but it does seem like once he went out, more veteran players come in, and all of a sudden you can get that flow state. And Steph Curry, of course, excels maybe more than any other player when the ball gets moving like that and everybody's reading and reacting. He punishes defenses at a historic level. If I go back to Iguodala, though, in his comment, the Nuggets veteran on the roster, I guess you could say Will Barton maybe is a veteran as well, but also Paul Millsap. And I wonder if the Nuggets, and Michael Porter in particular, could use a wing veteran. If there's like something to a guy that plays your position, that knows that has these things to maybe help him get along. Cause in my, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, in my estimation, Michael Porter has a long way to go to being able to play flow basketball at a high level.
Tell me what position Michael Porter is.
A forward.
What type of forward?
That is the thing.
I'm being honest with you.
So
I think he's a four man.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he thinks he's a three man.
Mm.
He's probably a three man and wants to be a two man.
Right. Mm.
And I think he's a four man. I think his most opportunities on this team is playing four. I haven't seen him in the four very much.
Yeah.
Again, he's been hurt. He's an inconsistent. He has a lot of competition at three. But now Barton's hurt, and now Harris is hurt.
Right,
and now there isn't competition at three. Now he's getting kind of slapped around because he's not playing very well. So I I'm with you. I think Michael Porter Jr. is going to be a really good player, but you want him to be a good player without playing. That's not going to happen. He's going to have to go through the process. He's not LeBron. He's not one of these kids that come into the league and then they play 30 or 40 games and they got it figured out.
Right.
That's not Michael Porter Jr. He's got to learn defense. He's got to put more weight on his body. He's got to learn to be professional on every possession rather than having what I call selfish possessions.
Right.
He throws a lot of junk into the game that because of his talent, we accept. But if it was RJ Hampton throwing that junk into the game, he wouldn't be playing.
Right. No doubt. No doubt about that. What do you think he's going through over these last 2 weeks? I'm going to read you off his stats. So I'm talking about Michael Porter here. 39% from the field, 25% from three. He's really been, you know, I think he's a confident guy. At times you could even say a cocky guy, just the way maybe he carries himself. And you could tell, I think he has a confidence crisis at the moment. He looks like he second guesses himself more than maybe he has in his entire life. But certainly since I've been watching him, what do you think he's going through when when he goes through a slump like this and so clear that he is a step behind everybody else, you know, the veteran players on this roster?
He's searching. And, the part we talked, the mental health part about being alone.
Yeah.
When you're searching and you're alone, it's not a fun place. I'm hoping he has some support. And, you know, I think the NBA is doing a better job. Every organization is doing more of a job of having people cater to when a guy's going. You know, there are a lot of times I would go to my assistant coaches, hey, take him out to lunch, go hang out with him, pick his brain, see out what's going on at home. How's everything with mom and dad or his family, whatever. I think you got to have a pulse there. But Michael Porter Jr. right now is just growing. I think he's picking up some habits that scare me a little bit. His balance on his shot. He's drifting more. He seems to be taking off balance shots much more often than before. I remember when my son wasn't playing very good in college basketball. And I kept telling him, I said, Kobe, I don't like your first two or three shots to be 3-point shots. I think it's best to go make a layup or go get an easy one.
Right.
Rather than put the stress on you that you got to make a shot.
Right.
You know, let the game give you some things before you go out hunting for some things. It's kind of where I think Michael was a little bit. He wants to score. That's what makes him tick. But he's got to understand he's got a lot of guys in the team that are better at him than scoring right now. And he's got to earn the right to take the shots that he takes.
I kind of feel, and this is projection because this is the COVID year. I'm not around. I'm not in the locker room. I'm not around these guys nearly as much. And even then, you know, you're only seeing so much. But I get the sense that he is learning that lesson quite a bit over this entire season, really. The whole idea of I've always been the best. I know I still can be the best. All these different things. But wow, these guys are better than me and they get it more than I do. And I need to like try to figure out what it is that they know. Do you get that sense at all from watching him? And I think that's part of the confidence being rattled is his realization of, wow, I'm actually behind all these guys.
You know, the feedback and feeling I get, when I talk to some guys is Michael Porter Jr.'s got a good head on his shoulders.
Right.
You know, they're not unhappy with his head. They're unhappy with his individual performances and maybe reactions at times.
Right.
And, you know, he's a young kid. Someone told me he wasn't even 21 yet. I mean, that's pretty amazing if you think about it. But for me, last year was an up and down year. I mean, until the bubble. And then he had some big nights in the bubble. But the whole thing now, everything about the bubble in this year I'm taking with a little bit of a grain of salt where, whoa, is that the real? Is that real? Or is that just the process, a part of the process? And I mean, Michael, you know, he would probably rather be going to Portland with a full house,
right,
or playing in front of a home crowd with a full house. That would help his confidence right there.
Right.
I mean, being in front of your home building and making that first shot and getting off and getting into a game, and all of a sudden the momentum of the game and the crowd carries you into a special night. You know, I think that's, you know, fans think that's easy to do, but playing 48 minutes, playing a complete game with greatness is really a special player.
I remember a couple of years back, I interviewed Kevin Durant. He's still with the Warriors. And I asked him about Jokic. Jokic was a really young player. I think it was his third season. And I asked him, you know, about Jokic and the talent, what he sees in him as an upside. And he said, he's a really talented. I mean, he's very complimentary. He said, he's an incredibly talented player, but the thing that differentiates talented players from the great ones in the NBA is the great ones learn they have to do it for 48 minutes every single night, every single time, because the rest of the team is looking at you and all these other things, and you realize that responsibility. And I think Jokic has grown into that responsibility over the last couple of years, but especially this year. I mean, in my opinion, he's been bringing it every night and just been – I'm impressed, obviously, with his scoring. And since we last spoke, he's shot 55% from the field, 46% from three, while averaging almost a triple-double. So his scoring has been up. But the thing that's I'm really most interested in with Jokic this season has been his leadership and has been sort of how he carries himself with the rest of the team. And with Michael Porter in particular, one of the stories of the last 2 weeks – Michael Porter took a horrible shot. I can't remember what game it was, Sacramento or Milwaukee game. A horrible shot. Jokic walks, doesn't even get back on defense. He dribbles up the court the next time, shoots a three, and then looks at Michael Porter and basically says, if you're going to take a bad shot, you might as well make it. And apparently those two had it out in the locker room a little bit. Or not had it out. That's not the right way. They spoke about it in the locker room. I'm curious what you think about from observing Jokic's leadership this year, what you've observed of him over the past years, and if you see growth, and if so, in what ways?
No question you're seeing growth. His consistency is great. You know, the thing that drove us all crazy is when he go in a game and play a half and not take two shots.
I think those games are gone.
Well, you know, he's only your best offensive player by far. I mean, the separation between him having the ball and the next guy having the ball is not even close right now. Jamal Murray will come back. I think he'll figure out his kind of his woes a little bit. But right now, you know, his efficiency is so much better than anybody else on the team. It's a joke. And I think I can actually see him thinking out there, well, should I take every shot? Or should I try to maybe make everybody else find someone else to find a shot? And you know, his personality right now is to be a playmaker. He likes making other guys better than probably making himself look good.
Sure.
But right now, his team might need him to take more responsibility, and I think he's learning that. Leading with a voice of unhappiness, that's a tougher situation. I think some great players like Kobe Bryant and LeBron and Michael and Bird, all those guys have had a history that they go after their teammates. But Jokic doesn't have that history. And so I think he's got to be gradual in building that up. He can't go from what he was the last 3 or 4 years and then become a snapping Chris Paul.
Right.
I don't think that'll work. I think he's got to gradually work into it and learn how to touch these guys in a positive way as a leader and demanding. And I have no problem being demanding. I think when players are demanding of each other, it makes the coaching easier.
Right. Do you feel like it's important for a star player on a team to be a little bit feared? And I don't mean feared, but, you know, guys be afraid of them. But we watched the Michael Jordan documentary. We know about Kobe Bryant. Guys knew when they came into practice, Michael Jordan was on the court. They need to be focused because they didn't want to get yelled at or humiliated by him or have it. Is that an important trait for a star player to carry?
I think yes, but there's so little practice going on these days.
Right.
I think, you know, I have a 16-year-old daughter who's a really good soccer player. And I tell her all the time, I know nothing about soccer. and I'm not really a big fan of soccer, but I tell her all the time, I say, Casey, not only do I want you to be the best player in the game, I want you to be the best player in practice.
Mm.
And a couple times meeting with her coaches, I've kind of got the feedback that's not important to her. And I'm going, well, you don't understand. It's really important to the
right,
team.
Right, right.
Because it makes the job so much easier when your best players know what to do and do it the right way every day. And it makes it easier for everybody to it makes it easier for everybody to demand that.
Right.
Accept that and respond to that. And it also makes the authority figure makes it easier to we can then have other priorities of demand, which is part of coaching.
But it's not just, I'm not even just speaking to practice. I'm also talking about games. And it goes back to the Iguodala thing from earlier where he would be so hard on players that they wouldn't want to be there. Or he'd tell them, hey, you need to get talk to your agent, get yourself out of here because you don't belong here. And like, that's extreme. That's maybe that's even going too far, but I'm just saying, would it be beneficial for the Nuggets if everybody was afraid of Jokic's criticism or, you know, in this type of way, so that every game, every moment, everybody was dialed in trying to do the right thing? What's the healthy balance there?
You know, if I was having this conversation with Jokic, I would tell him I want him to do it. I want him to get tougher. And you're going to make a mistake. You're going to have a fight. You're going to have an argument. And let me worry about that.
Right.
Let me help you through the process of becoming, for a better phrase, a tough-minded SOB type of leader.
Right.
Because, don't get me wrong. I mean, there have been quiet leaders who won NBA sure. championships. But most of them have a LeBron attitude, have a Bird attitude, have a Kobe attitude, have a Jordan attitude. Stockton, I heard, was kind of a, you know, he didn't cuss and moan very much, but he was demanding all the time. So, you know, I think anything that will bring mental toughness to this team in Denver would be good for everybody.
Yeah. We're going to move on. Let's skip over some of the stuff I had written down here, Coach. We're going to have to skip over because we're running out of time. But every week we've started a new series where every week we talk about one of your former players here with the Denver Nuggets and kind of just take a trip down memory lane and get some inside stories and your perspective on them. And this week we chose Nene, who was one of my favorite players during that whole era. He's one of the guys that was there for the entirety of, you know, we talk about that whole often the Carmelo era or the George Carl. He was there for a lot of that. I think from 2002 to 2011 or 12. Where do you want to go with this with Nene? What can you tell us about the kind of person he was and also just the type of player he was to coach?
Oh, I mean, I had a good relationship with Nene. I love him. We told each other we loved each other. I knew his first wife and his family. And through my cancer situations and his cancer situations, we had a kind of a community connection of how dangerous this game can be and how sad it would be if the game would be taken away from us. Nene was frustrating as a coach, though.
Yeah.
He did not have a, you know, you always wanted more because he was so talented.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, Nene was one of the strongest human beings I've ever coached.
So everybody says, but the number one thing people say about him.
I mean, he is so strong. I felt he could break me into. I mean, his hands, his body, his balance, his size. He would just destroy people in the weight room. I mean, he could have been a defensive end or a tight end. I mean, he could play football. I think he liked the game of basketball and he had very good basketball IQ. I think the language barrier affected him a little bit more than most people thought early in his career.
That's interesting.
I think towards the end of his career, he got better there.
Yeah.
The only frustration thing for a coach is when you got a player that's damn good, but you think he should be a little better.
Yeah.
You always feel you're not getting everything out of him. You kind of feel bad sometimes. And I think that's kind of where I was with Nene.
What do you think it was? You mentioned he liked the game, didn't say loved the game. I mean, maybe there was a distinction there, but also the injuries. I mean, he spent a good portion of his career you know, he missed a lot of games in his career, especially in Denver. What do you think it was?
I actually thought he had a, you know, I never could figure out Nene's desire with injuries. I mean, you know, I'm not saying, you know, American players, European players, South American players, they all kind of, I mean, you know, as I think Nene was one of those guys when he got hurt, he didn't really want to play hurt, as where most players, you know, when they're hurt, they try to figure out how to play hurt. And the theory is, you know, if you're hurt, you still play. If you're injured, you sit out.
Right, right.
And I don't think, I think Nene had some really serious injuries that were legit.
For sure.
But he took a lot of time getting back from them. You know, instead of being a 2 to, when the doctor told you it was 4 to 6 weeks, with Nene, we'd be saying it might be 7 or 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling was kind of divisional. It divided players a little bit. It divided coaches a little bit.
As a coach, what can you say in those moments? I mean, is there anything a coach can say? Hey, man, what's going on? You're taking a long time here. Or is that that breaks a trust or something? I mean, is there sort of a code to this?
Oh, I stayed away from that one. I mean, a long time. Earlier in my career, you could talk to players about injuries because there weren't so many people involved.
Yeah.
You know, when I first got in coaching, there was a doctor and a trainer. That's about it. Now you have a strength coach, weight coach, physiologist, psychologist. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have all these other guys chirping at you. And, you know, I came to Denver, I think I basically gave all the injury stuff to management and to the
trainer. Right. It's funny, you know, the commentary on Nene, because I feel, you know, the exact same way with him. I want to say he was an underrated player, and I think he kind of was, you know, and under the radar. In 2009, he had his best year. The Nuggets also had their best year. I think that's interesting. But part of why he was underrated, I think, is because you always knew he was better than what he performed. Every now and then you'd see it, and you'd be like, man, that I know he can do this. Why doesn't he do this every night? He could dominate this guy or that guy. And
Nene couldn't even do it a whole game.
Yeah,
Nene would play a first half, and we go to the locker room, and he'd have 16 points and 8 rebounds and 4 assists. And we're going, damn, what a night he's having, thinking he's going to go out and have the same second half.
Right.
He was happy with just being good.
Yeah.
He wasn't pushed. He didn't have that attitude of, I'm going to have my best night of the year here right now. I'm going to go get it. He was kind of happy when he played well. He kind of got happy.
I was laughed at one time when I asked Michael Malone if having a language barrier stunts a player's ability to lead a team. And I was talking about Jokic, of course. And when he first got here, his English wasn't very good. I saw Facundo Campazzo when he first arrived here, did a media session. I was surprised at how little he could understand from the reporters speaking English to him. You mentioned Nene there. Like, does the language barrier play does it diminish a player's ability to succeed in the NBA if they don't speak English that well?
Yes. Hell yes.
I got laughed at for asking this one time. Like, it was an absurd question. Of course not. So I'm happy to hear yes.
Well, you know, I coached in Spain for 2 years.
Oh,
and that was at a time where a lot of my players, you know, didn't understand English. And today, English is the basketball language of Europe. So, you know, everybody speaks English in Europe, in European League basketball right now. In Spain, when I coached there, it was interpreted. And, you know, the second year I tried to speak Spanish. And what was funny, I could speak Spanish in practice. But in the game, I couldn't do it.
That's hilarious.
I was always translating, and you know, I wasn't thinking in the language. And, in my situation, I just didn't feel like there was a great connection. You just kind of always had those moments where, are they listening? Are they hearing it? Are they hearing the right stuff? And, you know, just speaking to you in English, you're only comprehending 35% anyways. So what about a language barrier? You're probably, you comprehend 15%? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, Coach, this was another fantastic episode. It's always great. I'm telling you, every time. I know it was fun this time because I could tell I frustrated you a little bit. But I know I do, and I know the audience enjoys hearing those frustrations because it always sheds a new light and a new perspective on the things we're seeing. So,
I'm frustrated a little bit about the league because I don't think the games have been that great. We're still in that. First thing I wake up in the morning after I do my things I do, I usually look at what games I want to watch tonight.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of nights I'm going, hey, I don't, there's not a lot on the form.
Right.
And then some game, like I was really excited about last night's game. And I don't know, midway through the third quarter, I think we all knew that game was over.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to be that way until the playoffs. I hope we get really good playoff basketball, but it does seem like the circumstances of this season are just going to lend itself towards a lot of, as you put it, inconsistency amongst all of the teams. I don't know that the consistency is coming.
I mean, look at Boston. Do we expect Boston to be as poor? I mean, yeah, they have a couple of injuries, but, Milwaukee looks, why are they not, they're playing better, but. You know, like the two losses to Phoenix, now Phoenix has bounced back, but I think the injuries, the COVID stuff, the lack of whatever COVID and travel and the home court, whatever you want to throw out there.
Right.
It just doesn't seem like everybody. I just remember the times when we got in a rhythm and playing well. I mean, my last year in Denver when we won 17 in a row.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not. It was unbelievable how confident we were in winning. Yeah. But I don't see a team other than maybe Utah.
Right. Utah's in it for sure.
That has that attitude right now. I think the Lakers still scare everybody.
Right.
But right now the Lakers are playing like mid-season basketball. They're kind of bored with the game.
Totally. Yep.
And maybe it's just, it's cold weather. It's the middle of February. It's below zero outside. Maybe it's hard to commit to anything.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. But this was a fantastic episode. We didn't get to the ABA stuff. And you just did a podcast on the Truth in Basketball podcast with Dr. J. It talked a lot of ABA things. You also, some interesting players were brought up in that discussion that we'll have to push off to our next episode because I want to kind of pick your brain on that, namely David Thompson. I know Bobby Jones as well, another guy you have a lot of interesting insights on and perspective.
You got a lot of great Denver guys. You got Ralph Simpson and Fatty Taylor. Even going back to Warren Armstrong or Warren Jabali. I'm a big fan of the ABA. I think the ABA was... For some reason, ABA hasn't gotten the love it deserves, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And it saddens me because there are a lot of ABA guys that could use some financial help from the Players Association.
Mm.
There's a lot of ABA guys are my age. And there are a lot of guys that having health problems that could use a little more subsidies from the greatness in the money now in the NBA that wasn't there in the ABA days, but
right.
Maybe because of the ABA.
Correct. Yep.
It's there now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to have to table it though for our next episode. And there's a lot, I have a bunch of notes here. We're going to have to push it to that one. But in the meantime, you can check out Truth in Basketball. Of course, George Karl, Dr. J. So some good discussion on that. Until then, everybody, we'll see you guys all next time.